There was just once in my experience when it seemed impossible for me to see the unreality of the unlovely qualities of an individual, and see only the qualities of God. Then I found the citation in Science and Health that science, quote, lifts the curtain on man as never born, close quote. So I pulled down the curtain on the picture of a jealous, selfish, lying mortal, and faced the picture that science presented. When my fellow man was revealed as still in God, it was easy to see him loving, fearless, compassionate, and generous. I lived with that concept, and needless to say, the relationship became harmonious. Let me suggest that if there is anyone in your experience that it is difficult to see as perfect, pull down the curtain on the mortal image, and let science lift the curtain on man as never born. I can guarantee you will see the individual not as a gypsy, but as the son of the king. In realizing that we have never been born, we have to accept the glorious fact that we have never left heaven for earth. We are still living and moving and having our being in God. Therefore, our universe is the universe of divine consciousness. Our history is the eternal history of all is infinite mind and its infinite manifestation. This powerful truth reveals that there is nothing to affect us or influence us but God. In the kingdom of consciousness where we dwell, there is not even an Adam and Eve story to place a curse on us. There is no chaos, no destruction, no lack, no limitation, no conflict to harm us. There is no false theology to curse us and interfere with our welfare, whether we call it Catholicism, Lutheranism, or Communism. There are no medical laws to imprison us. Above all, there is no mortal mind to fear, hate, worry, tempt, envy, connive, lie, misrepresent, and so on. Since there is no mortal mind, there can be no mesmerism, animal magnetism, hypnotism to control us. All the unlovely destructive forces connected with the material universe and mortal history are completely wiped out, revealed as non-existent, with the immortal truth that man has never been born into matter. It is good to realize that not only are we immortal now, we have always been so. There has never been a beginning to immortality. There has never been an interruption in immortality with a material existence. In answer to God's question to Job, quote, "Where wast thou when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy?" Close quote. We can answer, we were there singing with the morning stars, and we were among those sons of God shouting for joy. Jesus was conscious of his spiritual preexistence when he uttered the grand prayer, quote, "And now, O Father, glorify thou me with thine own self, with the glory which I had with thee before the world was." Close quote. How easy it is to see that there could be no sickness, no sin, not even a belief in birth, before the world was. God was the only source, the only creator. He was glorifying man with his own selfhood, his own reality, his own substance, his own consciousness, his own being and action, his own law, his own reality, his own love, his own knowledge and understanding. The same is true today, for there never has been a material world or a story of material existence to interrupt immortality. Mrs. Eddy writes that it was Jesus' quote, steadfast and true knowledge of pre-existence, of the nature and inseparability of God and man, close quote, which made him mighty. Again, she states, quote, mortals will lose their sense of mortality, disease, sickness, sin, and death, in the proportion that they gain the sense of man's spiritual pre-existence as God's child, as the offspring of good, not of God's opposite, evil, or a fallen man. Close quote. It is important to be very sure when we use the term pre-existence, we are not thinking of a spiritual life preceding a material one, or of a material life preceding a material one. Many Orthodox religions teach that we left heaven for earth, thus lived spiritually before this material existence. Others teach a material existence before and a material existence now. Science disproves these misconceptions with the truth of uninterrupted immortality. Spiritual existence now, just as spiritual existence before the world was. Never anything but spiritual existence. Therefore, the only pre-existence must be spiritual. Before coming into science, I had been quite certain that we must have lived before. My concept of pre-existence was a material one. I was willing to accept immortality, life eternal, but I felt that there must be periods of mortality too. At the close of my class instruction, each of us was permitted to ask our teacher, John Randall Dunn, one question. He had stressed the point that the only pre-existence was spiritual. I still wasn't convinced. My question was, if we haven't had a material existence before this, why is it that Dorothy Reiki was born in America, has the privilege of education, finds Christian Science, and is even blessed with class instruction, whereas a Hindu born in India lives in poverty and filth, never rises above his caste system, much less is educated or even hears of Christian Science? If we have had no previous human experience to influence the status of our present experience, why should there be such a difference in our circumstances? Mr. Dunn's answer was a wise one. Quote, they are both just dreams. Close quote. Then I could see that my reasoning concerning pre-existence had been faulty, because it had not been based upon the scientific fact. I had reasoned that because we are experiencing a material existence now, surely then pre-existence must have been material. Quote, for right reasoning, Mrs. Eddy says, quote, there should be but one fact before the thought, namely spiritual existence. In reality, there is no other existence, since life cannot be united to its unlikeness, mortality. Close quote. When I denied the present dream of mortal existence, I could really see that our pre-existence was the same as now, spiritual, perfect, uninterrupted immortality. All the time, both the Hindu and I had no material history. All the time, neither of us had ever been a gypsy. All the time, we both had been living in God, both boundlessly blessed by all of His infinite resources, and both fully aware of our spirituality and immortality and our oneness with the Father. In order to be sure we would receive the right impression of uninterrupted immortality when speaking of pre-existence, Mrs. Eddy linked it with the word coexistence. Let us hear the inspirational way in which she used the term. Quote, "Science reverses the evidence of material sense with the spiritual sense that God, Spirit, is the only substance, and that man, his image and likeness, is spiritual, not material. This great truth does not destroy, but substantiates man's identity, together with his immortality and pre-existence, or his spiritual coexistence with his Maker." Close quote. Having agreed that we are immortal now and always have been, then is not the term of coexistence a better one to use? Rather than suggestion of a past, a present, and a future, coexistence brings out the uninterrupted immortality of the eternal now. Having agreed that we are immortal now, and always have been, let us contemplate the fact that we always shall be immortal. Here is where most Christian faiths agree that our future holds immortality. But they differ from Christian Science in this respect. They feel that they must die in order to find immortality, whereas we understand that we must go on living in order to continue demonstrating immortality. Since life is God, and God is the only life, that life is our life. That life knows no death, not even a phase called passing on. Christ Jesus taught, preached, and lived the truth that life is eternal, and there is no death. It is in the story of Lazarus that we hear the glorious promise, quote, "I am the resurrection and the life. He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. And whosoever liveth and believeth in me shall never die. Believest thou this?" Close quote. Jesus' resurrection from death and his ascension were overwhelming proofs that man is eternal. Over and over in her writings, our leader brings out the unreality, the complete non-existence of the death process. Countless are the times she makes the statement, "There is no death." Certainly, then, we should neither fear death as an enemy nor welcome it as a friend, only regard it as absolutely nothing, hence completely non-existent. How wonderful it is to know that our spiritual understanding, our health, our immortality, is not aided by a friend called death, hence no false friend to welcome. Our health, spiritual understanding, and immortality is of God and will ever continue to appear from that inexhaustible source. Have you been regarding death as a friend, as an enemy, or as absolute nothingness? There appeared in the Reader's Digest of February 1952 a condensation of the book The Will to Live by Dr. Arnold A. Hutchnecker. Much that this gentleman advocated was scientific in approach. I was greatly impressed that everything this enlightened physician had to say pointed to the fact that no one ever passes on unless he has planned it. What are you planning? Are you planning on living or planning on dying? Be careful. Sometimes the planning can be very subtle. you stoutly declare, quote, I shall never die, close quote. But have you bought your cemetery lot? Have you made a will? Do you carry life insurance? Do you have your house in order so that if you pass on, you won't be embarrassed with the condition in which others will find it? Dr. Hutchnicker makes this significant observation, quote, how often we find the victim of a sudden and unheralded heart attack has been consulting his lawyer about his will, or has recently taken out a new life insurance policy. Not long ago, I caught myself on this one. I don't think I will ever see another war. Now, wait a minute, I said. What are you thinking? That you will never live to see another war? Or that there just won't be any more wars? Because I am planning on living, I could not possibly admit that I might pass on before another war occurred in a material universe. I had to rejoice that there could be no wars in the realm of divine consciousness where I live eternally. I know of a case where, in spite of the help given by a devoted, sincere, consecrated practitioner, the individual passed on. When friends called at the mortuary, the family proudly displayed a letter that the patient had written several months before passing on. It is true, the letter was beautifully written, and some sweet sentiments were expressed. But this patient planned so surely on death that she had written a letter to that effect. Everyone else thought it was a wonderful letter. I didn't. I felt the patient could have made far better use of her time cooperating with the practitioner and planning on living rather than dying. Sometimes you hear the statement, "What's the matter with practitioners? Why are so many scientists passing on?" Here is one answer. Too many are planning on dying. Let all of us right here and now start planning to live, and live abundantly. Quit saving your money so you can leave it to your children. Isn't that another subtle bit of planning? Live now. Use your resources now, and know that the same loving Heavenly Father will continue to provide for you abundantly and boundlessly, and for all your children, just as He did before the world was. In Science and Health, Mrs. Eddy speaks of death as, quote, but another phase of the dream that existence can be material, close quote. Therefore, death is nothing. It is illusion. It is only a part of the Adam and Eve story that man can be born into matter, live in matter, and die in matter. But a story it is, and only a story. We can relegate all phases of life and matter to the realm of pure fiction. But even in the realm of fiction, death is nothing, no thing. Even those who think they have passed on in the Adam dream of existence would be the first to tell you that nothing really happened. It was my privilege to participate in a panel discussion at Indiana University during Religion in Life Week a couple of years ago. Included in these were a Jewish rabbi and a Methodist minister. I made the statement to the effect that God really intended for us to be happy. The Jewish rabbi objected seriously. He felt that there were times when we should be very unhappy, in fact, mournful. He felt that it was God's will that we be so. He gave an example of the possibility of a man dying during the time he was erecting a magnificent building. He made the point of how awful it was that the man would never be able to finish what he had started. He asked us, shouldn't the acquaintances and friends and the family of this man mourn for him? I did not even have to give the answer, for the Methodist minister spoke up with these words, no, I don't agree with you. I cannot help but feel that man would go right on building. The bell rang, and there was no further opportunity for discussion. But I was certainly grateful to have the discussion end on that note. Here was a minister of the gospel who was willing to indicate the nothingness of death to the extent that an individual could go right on with the task at hand. Mrs. Eddy points out that passing on introduces no radical change in man's experience, and that he goes right on with his work. She spoke of the passing of Joseph Armstrong, quote, "The late lamented Christian Scientist brother and the publisher of my books, Joseph Armstrong, CSD, is not dead, neither does he sleep nor rest from his labors in divine science, and his works do follow him. Evil has no power to harm, to hinder, or to destroy the real spiritual man. He is wiser today, healthier and happier than yesterday. The mortal dream of life, substance, or mind and matter has been lessened, and the reward of good and punishment of evil will end in harmony. Evil is powerless, and God, good, omnipotent, and infinite." Close quote. In the archives of the Mother Church, there is a letter known as the Riley Letter. It is a response to a family by the name of Riley who had lost a child. In the letter to Mrs. Eddy, they stated that they realized there was but one life, that life had no beginning and no ending. But what seemed to happen to an individual when he passed on? In sharing the contents of Mrs. Eddy's reply, I'm not quoting exactly, but I know that my statements are all correct, and almost word for word as they appear in the letter. Quote, "Suppose two people were sitting and talking together. An archer comes to the window and shoots an arrow through one. According to the other, the individual slumps back on the chair dead, and there is a body to dispose of. This, however, is only his human concept of what happened. That is not at all the concept of the one who was shot by the arrow. He goes right on talking to his friend. When he sees that he can no longer communicate with him, he takes with him his human concept of himself and goes to find those with whom he can communicate. If he were to look around and look at the chair in which he had been sitting, it would be empty." Close quote. Does not this letter make it clear that nothing very drastic happens in the experience of the dream called passing on? In my own experience, there were several instances of individuals who had passed on and been revived. I am choosing to share with you just one of these instances. I have selected it because of the many important points we gain from it. All the rest corroborate this one instance. A young woman had lost her mother many years before. In the spring, she had lost a baby. Now it was fall, and to all appearances to those at the bedside, she had passed on. This was her experience. When she could no longer talk to those at the bedside, she arose from the bed, walked over to the window, and there, in the garden below, looking years younger than when she last saw her, was her mother holding the baby. More than anything she had ever done, this young woman wanted to go down to the mother and child. But it was at that point that she realized that this is what is called passing on. She had been taught very definitely by her teacher never to consent. She realized that if she went down to the dear ones in the garden, she would be consenting. Then she heard Mr. Dunn's words, "Never consent, never consent." She said the most difficult thing she had ever done in her life was to turn around and walk back to the bed. But she was obedient to what she had been taught. She returned to the bed, and it was then that those praying were able to revive her.